The second part of this is the battle for Britain. And I'm going to let it play to show how the Nazis destroyed Europe and enslaved most of the people in Europe less than 100 years ago. December 1st, the German armies, without warning, blitzed into Poland. On September 3rd, the British and French declared war on Germany. The Nazis, Hitler lied to everybody. By September 27th, the Germans had wiped out Poland and met the oncoming Russian army. Determined to avoid a two-front war, Germany halted her drive to the east and turned west to first crush Britain and France. Less than 100 years ago. Let's all wake up. The Nazis are still ambitious to rule the world as the Antichrist, using the Muslims,
Canada,
the Catholics,
Australia,
the Jesuits,
New Zealand, South Africa. The whole British Commonwealth.
The Communist Chinese. The Communist Chinese weren't communist at the time this all happened.
And Britain had one weapon that was ready, the Royal Navy. Shortly after war was declared, it had swept German shipping from the high seas. And units of the British fleet were deployed at Suez, Malta, Gibraltar, in the Channel, and in the North Sea, blockading Germany. World conquest was impossible without running smack up against the rock called Britain. How to strike at that little island? That was the question. Between Britain and Germany stood not only France, but the little countries of Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. The people of these small neutral countries were peaceful, hardworking, and free. They knew they were in the middle and feared violation of their neutrality. Hitler knew this. He also knew that if they united with the Allies, they would form a solid democratic wall against Nazi aggression, and their conquest would be far more difficult. So before striking with his armies, he used another weapon, the propaganda barrage, to confuse, to make them lose faith, to divide and conquer. To lull the fears of the little neutrals, propaganda minister Goebbels told them Germany didn't want a war at all. It was Britain and France that caused all the trouble. Then it was Hitler's turn. In a speech on October 6, 1939, he made them all kinds of specific promises. To the Danes, he said, "We have concluded a non-aggression pact with Denmark." To the Norwegians, he said, "Germany never had any conflict with the northern states and has none today." To the Dutch, he said, "The new Reich has endeavored to continue the traditional friendship with Holland." And to the Belgians, he announced, "The Reich has put forth no claim which might in any way be regarded as a threat to Belgium." And while Hitler was making these promises, his generals were cold-bloodedly picking out the first victim. Norway. And why did they pick Norway? Its many steep inlets or fjords would make excellent U-boat bases from which raiders could prey on British supply lines. Also, it would give the Nazis vital air bases. This is Scapa Flow, British naval base, and this the blockade fleet. At this time, the German-based bombers couldn't reach them. Possession of bases on Norway's western shore would bring these vital British defenses under easy bomber attack. But he couldn't take Norway without also taking tiny Denmark, the springboard for his attack. So at dawn on April 9th, 1940, the German army rolled across the neutral borders of Little Denmark, and in a matter of hours it occupied the entire country. By nightfall, Denmark is erased as a nation, and the Danes go into slavery. Although only 6 months before, Hitler had announced, "We have concluded a non-aggression pact with Denmark. The Danes will not forget." Meanwhile, in Norway, peaceful-looking German merchant ships like these had sneaked inside Norway's neutral waterway and tied up at all principal ports. That is, they looked like merchant ships. But if the Norwegians had had X-ray eyes, this is what they would have seen. The Trojan horse of ancient Greece brought up to date with new and deadlier weapons. At the precise moment that the Nazis overran Denmark, these quiet-looking ships sprang to life. At the same time, Nazi warships, discovered along the entire coastline, started steaming up the Norwegian fjords. Ships, transports, tanks, men, planes, all flung themselves simultaneously upon a defenseless country. Airborne infantry seized every strategic Norwegian airport. The whole job was made easier by treacherous fifth columnists, led by Major Quisling, who seized power and issued orders to suppress resistance. Nazi warships steamed past silent guns that could have blasted them out of the water. This was one of the most amazing acts of treachery the world has ever known. It brought Major Quisling international fame, making his very name synonymous with the word traitor. By the afternoon of April 9th, the Germans were in complete control of all seven ports where they had landed in the morning. For the first time in more than 200 years, the people of Norway saw an invading army parading through their cities. Many of these Nazi soldiers, strutting as conquerors in 1940, had last seen Norway some 20 years earlier, when as refugee German children they had been raised and cared for by kind Norwegians. Now these same Germans were back to repay that kindness with terror and destruction. Once they had occupied the capital, the Nazis quickly fanned out in all directions. But loyal Norwegian troops stopped one German column between Hamar and Elvera. So the Germans brought up their bombers. Unopposed air attack. It was here that Captain Robert Lozay, an American military attaché, was killed, the first American soldier to lose his life in this war. Meanwhile, the Nazis had spread all over the country. Small patrols occupied every strategic village. Parachute troops landed high in the mountains. Bombing raids sent defenseless civilians fleeing in stark terror. They hadn't wanted war. They had done everything to avoid it. Hoping they could escape the Nazi scourge, they had compromised and tragically failed to unite with the other democracies. And now they faced the scourge defenseless and alone. For before the Allies could come to their aid, the Germans were in control of all principal ports.
Regardless of this, British, French, and Polish contingents plunged in and made several landings along the Norwegian coast. They landed forces north and south of Trondheim and attempted an encircling movement on the city under constant, heavy, and almost entirely unopposed air attack. While the scene of action was out of range of British fighter planes, so they brought up aircraft carriers. But these are at a disadvantage when opposed by land-based planes. The Allies, therefore, were badly battered from the air. Finally, suffering heavy losses, they withdrew from the hopeless situation. Further to the north, at Narvik, they met with better success, inflicting heavy naval losses on the Nazis. The town for nearly 2 months. Incidentally, they also took their first prisoners of the present war. Again, the Nazis' overwhelming air superiority proved a deciding factor. The Allies were forced to withdraw under terrific air bombardment. Before, Hitler had said,
Germany never had any conflict with the northern states and has none today. The Norwegians will not forget.
And Hitler. Hitler had another victory. He had hijacked two more countries. The world wondered and sometimes marveled at this man's efficiency. Gangster Dillinger was efficient too. When a man or a nation throws away all regard for the laws of God and man, he is bound at first to be more efficient than his victims. Society had a police force to deal with gangster Dillinger, but it had no police force to deal with gangster Hitler. So he clubbed Norway into submission and got what he wanted, bases for use against Britain. Now he had the northern claw of an enormous pincer movement. A drive through France would give him the southern claw. Blockade by U-boats coupled with mass bombing attacks would weaken the British for final invasion. Then, with Britain gone, Germany could reach out in all directions for world conquest. His next move must obviously be through France to get his southern claw. Through France. How was she to face the onslaught? These scenes are ancient history. They occurred in 1914. The German armies, without warning, had smashed across neutral Belgium, invaded France, reached the River Marne only a few miles from Paris. Out of the French capital poured the French reserves, riding out to battle the enemy in every vehicle that could move. famous taxicab army. Note well, it was riding out two batsmen. In the center of the French line stood the 9th French Army, commanded by a then comparatively unknown general. On September 5th, 1914, he is reputed to have said, "My right is driven in. My center is giving way. The situation is excellent. I attack." Was checked, and Paris was saved. That comparatively unknown general later became commander-in-chief of all the Allied armies and presided at the signing of the armistice with the defeated Germans on November 11, 1918. To this general, the French people erected a monument. To Marshal Ferdinand Foch, whose motto was, "Attack, always attack."
Still later, the war-weary French people erected another monument. This one to a minister of war, André Maginot. Between the ideas symbolized by these two statues may well lie the military story of the fall of a great nation. In Foch's time, the proud spirit of France demanded nothing less than victory and placed its faith in the attack. In Maginot's time, the spirit, no longer proud, asked only to avoid defeat and placed its faith in concrete. So the French built the mighty chain of fortresses called the Maginot Line. These tremendous bastions were built deep into the French land. They were connected by underground passages and railways, guarding France's eastern borders facing Germany. And when France was finally forced to declare war against the rising Nazi menace, the French troops, instead of attacking, were marched into their modern caves to wait for the Nazi blitz to smash itself against the Maginot Line. And their generals, headed by Marshal Pétain, proudly announced, "Whoever makes the first move in this war will be hurt." But Hitler didn't go near the Maginot Line. That was France's strong point. Instead, he attacked the weak point. Hitler knew that the French had tried to avoid war instead of preparing for it. That knowledge was one of his greatest weapons. He knew they had planes, but he knew they were antiquated. He knew they had tanks, but he knew they were few in number and lightly armored. But most important of all, he knew that France had become a cynical and disillusioned nation. What made this change in the French spirit? In the first place, between 1914 and 1918, the French suffered more than 6 million casualties in the heroic defense of their land against German invasion. The flower of an entire generation was lost, with its stimulus of new blood, new determination, new ideals. Secondly, the failure of the League of Nations, to which the French had pinned their hopes of peace, the corruption of many in high places, the greed of special interests, all had combined to shake the faith of the French people in their democratic ideals. And when a people loses its faith in its own ideals, it is ripe for the insidious words of the devil. France still looked like an imposing castle. But Hitler's political termites had so gnawed away the binding of national unity that the castle was ready to crumble. Inactivity that we call the phony war, a ceaseless barrage of German propaganda crossed the still waters of the Rhine to affect the soldiers in the Maginot Line. Why do you fight, asked the banners. Poems and friendly notes were sent over by balloons. French tunes were played by German bands. And German hooey was broadcast in French. The British will fight to the last drop of French blood. You have been deceived. This is an imperialistic war for Britain. We Germans want nothing of France. What is happening to your wives back home, soldiers? The British are stationed in your villages. Yes, France was ready to be plucked. The whole force of the Nazi might was turned toward the west. How would they strike this time? Through Alsace-Lorraine, is it 1870? Through the Low Countries, is it 1914? What was the 1940 model conquest? The French considered the Maginot Line utterly impregnable, and therefore believed the Germans would again try a swing through the Low Countries, as in 1914. But even after Hitler's rape of Scandinavia, Holland and Belgium, hoping against hope, still clung to their neutrality. So the French massed 78 divisions here along the border of Belgium. 17 were in the Maginot Line. 10 divisions here in case Mussolini got bold. 3.5 as a safeguard against Spain. The British had 10 divisions here. The Allied strategy in the event of an attack against the Low Countries was to swing their armies like a gate into Belgium, the hinge being the north end of the Maginot Line. This all-important hinge was protected by the forest of the Ardennes, a hilly and thickly wooded area, honeycombed with streams, its roads narrow trails, its bridges too weak for military vehicles. French strategists estimated the forest of the Ardennes impassable for armored forces. As you will see, this was one of the costliest estimates in all military history. That was the situation on May 9, 1940. The hour of trial had come. The people of the democracies prayed for strength to meet the coming hurricane of terror. Across the Rhine. A delirious madness possessed the German nation.
Nun als Dauererscheinung für uns, unser Oberster, für die Kriegsführung der Allgemeinen immer wieder herniedersteigen. Dass man die Wahrheit über Deutschland bei 50.000 Mann auf den Baustellen der ganz Deutschland erfasste, überall herrscht seit einem Jahr Regen und für den deutschen Ex die Reinheit seiner Rasse. Hitler ist Deutschland wie Deutschland, deshalb innerlich nicht zu uns gehört.
Bothering to declare war, the German armies launched a coordinated attack. across the neutral borders of Luxembourg, Belgium, and Holland, from the Maginot Line north to the sea. The action along the entire front was simultaneous, so for purposes of clarity, let's take up one country at a time. First, let's see what happened in Holland. Forces smashed through the improvised and hastily erected border defenses. But the main attack was to come from the air, far behind the defense lines. Troops were landed in this manner. Before the stunned citizens of Rotterdam even knew they were at war, these troops, aided by well-trained fifth columnists, quickly captured the airport and outlying sections of the city. Meantime, Nazi armored columns were racing across the country, their progress speeded by other fifth columnists who prevented the destruction of vital dikes and bridges. These forces effected a meeting with the parachutists landed in Rotterdam. The Dutch were doomed to defeat. On the fourth day of the invasion, the Nazis gave the Dutch general an ultimatum. All Dutch resistance must cease, or Rotterdam will be bombed flat. General had little choice. To save the lives of innocent civilians, he accepted the German terms. But after the unconditional surrender, the Nazis bombed the city anyway. Twice the unopposed German bombers flew low over the center of Rotterdam and methodically bombed it into a heap of rubble. The world has ever seen. Over 30,000 men, women and children were killed in the space of 90 minutes. Though only 6 months before, Hitler had said, the new Reich has endeavored to continue the traditional friendship with Holland. The Dutch will not forget. Meantime, in Belgium, the whole force of Nazi Blitzkrieg had stormed across its neutral borders. The main German attack was directed at the Albert Canal Meuse River line, the anchor of which was Fort Ebenemail, a modern and seemingly impregnable fortress. The Germans had secretly built a replica of the mighty fortress in Czechoslovakia and had rehearsed the attack until they knew every detail of the fort's construction and its every weakness. When the real attack came, it was foolproof. Parachute troops, dive bombers, plane force, specially trained engineer battalions, all working together as a well-trained team. They knew exactly where to cross the river. Where to put his high explosive charge in order to destroy the blockhouse. Fort Ebenemail withstood the Nazi attack exactly 2 days, and the German armies rolled on. Meantime, an hour and a half after the German invasion began, Allied troops crossed the French and Belgian border to meet the advancing Germans. As they raced across Belgium to take up their defense positions, they met an obstacle they hadn't counted on. Refugees. Choked roads didn't get that way by accident. The Nazis methodically bombed little towns and villages, otherwise devoid of any military value, not so much to kill as to drive the inhabitants out onto the highway. Then, by expert machine gunning, the Nazis would herd them along in terror-stricken flight to hopelessly entangle the advancing Allied armies. Refugees used as a weapon of war, a new low in inhumanity.
No school today, the sign says. The children are otherwise occupied. No. No school today. Might in any way be regarded as a threat to Belgium. The Belgians will not forget. And what about the Allies? They were convinced that the German attack on Belgium and Holland was the main thrust, and according to plan, it swung their armies like a gate into Belgium. But the attack on Belgium and Holland was only a feint. The main German attack was to be centered where the Allies least expected it, through the Ardennes forest. For this decisive blow, they had secretly assembled the mightiest striking force the world had ever seen, including 45,000 armored vehicles.
Time that the Nazi armies were plunging into Holland and Belgium, this column started to move.
By the
following day, shock troops were able to get across the river.
Power doomed this valiant unit to destruction. On May 21st, the German spearhead reached the channel port of Abbeville. Protecting their flank along the Somme, the Germans fanned out to the north and east. This was to be the perfect battle of annihilation. On May 28th, the Belgian army, compressed into a small space and weary of battle, laid down its arms. That left the desperate French and British defenders with their backs to the sea at the small channel port of Dunkirk.
One of the greatest disasters in history seemed in the making. An entire British army faced annihilation. But out of the fog and the mist shrouding the channel came a strange armada of Navy craft, fishing boats, pleasure yachts, anything that would float. The seagoing people of Britain had come to rescue their army. High overhead, British fighter planes fought the Luftwaffe to a standstill. Suicide units held the German back long enough for the miracle of Dunkirk to take place. British troops, plus 112,500 French and Belgians were rescued. Over 300,000 battle-tested men, grimly determined to go back again with new tools, new weapons with which to blast the hated Nazis out of this world. For free men are like rubber balls. The harder they fall, the higher they bounce. Leading the British by this time was a man who had been bouncing all his life, Winston Churchill, who had tried for years to warn the world about Germany. Meantime, the situation that faced France was as nearly hopeless as a military situation can be. Two-fifths of the French army was lost. There were fewer than 50 divisions left to defend a front almost 200 miles long, running from the northern end of the Maginot Line to the sea. And behind that thin front line, there were no reserves. The despairing people of Paris sent their children south, praying that some miracle would keep them from harm. The hopeless men of the French army, without adequate arms or equipment, braced themselves for the coming blow.
The first blow fell on June 5th. The French resistance was determined, but by June 8th, the left flank army had been shattered, and a general withdrawal was ordered to the line of the Marne and the Seine. On June 9th, the German main attack came. Within 2 days, the German armored and motorized divisions roared out into the open terrain. With this breakthrough, the issue of the Battle of France was decided, and from that time on, there was official talk of an armistice. Now, what about the famous Maginot Line? Let's go back and take a look. On June 14th, the Germans launched two attacks against the Maginot Line. In both cases, penetration